Time for the Friday edition of Hancock and Kelly.
You two belong together.
John Hancock, Michael Kelly on News Radio 1120, KMOX.
So did you stay up late for it last night?
No. For what?
What do you mean for what?
What? I don't. What are you talking about? I went to bed early last night. You got a good night's sleep.
You have a young granddaughter, right? Miss Tula?
Tula. She'll be two.
So only 2 years old. She's too early for it.
For what?
My gosh, Taylor Swift came out with a new album last night at midnight. Buddy, I'm telling you, there's teenage girls and grown women who woke up last night in the middle of the night to hear this album. And, you know, of course, in Taylor fashion, it's taking the world by storm. I thought you'd be up watching it.
Yeah, no. Is it any good?
Buddy, it's Taylor Swift. You know it's going to be good. But listen, you better get into this.
Why?
Because this is what the kind of stuff Tula's going to be into.
Taylor Swift? She will be passe by the time Tula's a teenager.
I bet not.
Bet she is.
Well, let me just tell
you. You know how these things go. The Beatles thought they were going to be popular for 2 or 3 years.
And they were popular for almost 100.
Yeah, but then that's one in a million.
Well, I think you may.
By the way, we've got a guest next hour that recorded
with Taylor Swift
at Abbey Road Studios. He's a St. Louis guy. That's going to be interesting.
Yeah, that'll be a good conversation. Well, I'm a little disappointed you didn't stay up for it.
I did not. I did not.
Yeah. How was your drive-in?
Oh man. So you know, not a lot of traffic, as we'll find out here in a couple of minutes. But there was, I don't know whether it was Mario Andretti or what the heck, this guy was driving 100 miles an hour, Highway 40, Michael.
Yeah.
He's driving 100 miles an hour, he's cutting over three lanes at a time and swerving in and out of traffic.
Yeah, why not, right?
Poof, and he was gone.
Yeah.
But how do people get
that
away with this?
That happens in my neighborhood.
What?
Yeah.
In your neighborhood?
Right there on Kings Highway, once you get off and you're heading north there on Kings Highway. I guess there's like 10 red lights in a row, and rarely, especially late at night, you'll see people blowing that sucker.
And are they driving fast?
Fast! Fast! They'll go plowing through lights without people. And
that's terrible.
It is scary, especially on the highway, because, you know, you're being particularly conscious, and then all of a sudden, they kind of swerve right in front of you.
Yeah, that's what happened to me. I was in the left lane doing, somebody a lot.
Yeah.
And whoosh, this guy, the thing. I mean, it was like being over at what's it called over there, the Gateway.
Yeah, at the racetrack.
Yeah.
Did you feel a bit intimidated by the guy?
Like, no, I was angry.
Did you shake your fist at him, or did you just mutter something?
I don't know.
At KMOX, our focus is you, your go-to station for local news that matters to St. Louis and the region.
That's my gal, Taylor Swift there. I didn't stay up late listening to her. Neither did John Hancock. But I did still wake up early, John, to hear about all of this news that took place. We finally saw a reaction from the state of Israel against Iran. It doesn't appear to have been as massive as a strike as Iran put on Israel. And it doesn't appear that many people have died in this. What's your take? What happened and what's next?
Well, I think Israel demonstrated here that if they so choose, they can penetrate whatever the air defenses Iran has, and that was an important message sent, I think, and they picked Isfahan, which is the site of Iran's nuclear program, and that was not an accident. And so I think it was, you know, it was akin to leaving a calling card and basically saying, okay, cut it out. When I first heard the reports, I was concerned that it might be escalatory to draw the whole region into conflict. I don't think that was the purpose here. Interesting, too, that we know that the Biden administration has strongly urged Israel not to respond to those drone strikes from Iran. And Israel did anyway. So there's clearly some tension between the U.S. and Israel right now at a time when Israel's at war, which we've not seen historically since the creation of the Israeli state in the 1940s.
Way too much to get into now, but there also is political tension inside of Israel.
There is.
Netanyahu fighting for his political life.
Yeah.
His polling continues to tank. Obviously, he's been a thorn inside the Biden administration, got along well with the Trump administration. we'll see how that all shakes out.
Yeah, Donald Trump moved the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, which was very welcome by Israel.
Yeah, and now we have our own dysfunction to deal with here in the United States that deals directly with Israel and Ukraine. Of course, the United States Senate, led by Chuck Schumer and the Democrats, at the behest of the administration, passed a piece of legislation that bundled the aid together of Israel, Ukraine, and dealing with
Taiwan
and Southeast Asia. That got passed, sent over to the House. Of course, some of the Republicans have said they don't want to deal with the Ukraine thing. Speaker Johnson has finally acquiesced. He has busted these up into three separate pieces of legislation that are likely to be considered this weekend. He says he will move to support the Ukraine legislation, even though there's a growing movement on the Republican side. These bills should pass with bipartisan support, but they're going to have long-term consequences.
Yeah, I think they will pass. I think they should pass. I wish they would have passed earlier. Ukraine's basically gone through a season here where they just haven't had the munitions to effectively defend their country. And they continue taking daily assaults from Russia, who make these indiscriminate airstrikes into apartment buildings and hospitals. And it's just, you know, they're war crimes they're committing over there. And I do not understand, and it's a small number, but a growing number of Republican voices, led by, I guess, Marjorie Taylor Greene, basically is saying that, you know, Ukraine is out there, you know, hurting Christians, which is not the case.
This isn't even about religion.
No. And I mean, if you want to find a regime that's unfriendly to Christianity, look to Vladimir Putin. So I don't understand a lot of the talking points, and it seems to me that a lot of the talking points that I'm hearing coming out from some of the Marjorie Taylor-esque people in the Republican Party are straight out of Moscow.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Moscow state-run press out there is turning her into a hero in Russia. That's no good. But here you've got Donald Trump, who says he's not going to give a penny to Ukraine, who's running for president. I think that is such a flawed approach to our own national security. When you've got a democratic country who's been invaded, defending their territory against an authoritarian regime, and that democratic country is making great impacts in destabilizing the Russian military, that is to the benefit of the West and to the United States.
How much do you think of their position, Marjorie Taylor Greene and a couple of these others that are anti-Ukraine, is really substantive policy-based, or is it attention-based? Because I saw a photo yesterday of Marjorie Taylor Greene leaving the United States Capitol. And mm-hmm. John, I'm not kidding. There were more cameras around her than follow the president of the United States. I had a little experience when I was on the presidential campaign with Mr. Gephardt. I'll never forget coming out of a hotel the day before the caucuses. And there's something intoxicating about 300 or 400 cameras pointed at you at one time. And I witnessed it personally how it affected people who were stable and rational. I think she's just chasing attention. I don't even think she knows. I don't even think she could tell you where the capital of Russia is.
Well, I don't think she would ever be a returning champion on Jeopardy.
Right.
And I do think that, yeah, there's far too many members of both parties in Congress who are there primarily to garner the spotlight. And that's not how governing works best. And it's not in the best interest in this case of the United States, our domestic policy, and certainly not our national security policy. But I do think both of those will pass. And then you've got the possibility that Speaker Johnson is going to face.
That's where I wanted to go next.
Yeah, well, that's why I went.
There's going to be some consequences as it relates to this. Of course, there's been a movement, ridiculous rules that Kevin McCarthy agreed to, where one member could cause this type of thing to happen.
Yeah.
It was inevitable it was going to happen to Kevin McCarthy. It appears to be inevitable that it's going to happen to Speaker Johnson. Some folks on my side of the aisle are saying, hey, to bring stability about this, we may wind up voting with the Republicans to save Speaker Johnson. I don't know what's going on, John. I think the dysfunction is bad brand for the Republican Party. How's this all going to shake out?
I don't know. If they bring a petition to vacate the speakership, which is what that would be, it could be brought by one member. It's a privileged motion at that point. And it will go to the floor. And then it'll be up to, it'll only take a few Democrats to say, this is ridiculous, and then that's the end of it. If the Democrats stick together as they did when McCarthy
was
there.
Which, by the way, is also their role.
Well, and that you
to vote for their own speaker.
And you could talk about the politics of it. I mean, the politics of it probably makes some sense.
For the chaos.
Yeah. Yeah.
From a Democratic perspective, to sit back and say, hey, you Republicans fight this out.
Yeah, you can't, we're not going to solve your problem for you.
Right.
You've done this to yourselves. That's probably the better politics. But for the institution,
right. It's
better to have the speaker be the speaker. And I got to tell you, as I gaze over the hill at the elections coming up now, I'm beginning to believe Donald Trump is going to win this election. But I think it's going to be very tricky for the Republicans to hold the U.S. House in November. Counterintuitive. That's really bucks historical trends. When the out party wins the White House, they usually have large gains in Congress.
Yeah, but that's also an area where the elections are small enough that it can be about some issues can make a difference, like abortion.
Well,
in the suburbs.
22 districts, I think, that Republicans hold in districts that Joe Biden won in 2020.
Right.
So those seats are immediately in jeopardy. So, now, conversely,
United
just because
States
of
Senate's
the map,
in trouble for the Democrats.
I think the Republicans are going to take the U.S. Senate, especially, certainly, if Trump wins the White House, the Republicans will take the U.S. Senate.
Yeah, it is it's going to be exciting as we race towards the primary process. We continue to see some of these peripheral issues that may pop up. Hey, you found something interesting that was proposed here in the state of Missouri.
Yeah, our legislature takes a lot of incoming. Because it has had its moments of dysfunction in recent years. But we learned a couple of years ago that the Division of Child Services in the state was grossly understaffed coming out of COVID. And the volume of child abuse complaints that get phoned in, turned in, anonymous sometimes, they just didn't have the capacity to deal with it. Now, they've staffed up considerably since that time. And I heard on this radio station a few weeks ago, the head of that division interviewed, and he was explaining that, they've upped their staff and they're handling a bigger caseload, but the backlog is thousands.
Wow.
Thousands. And so the bill that's passing is allowing private contractors to be hired to investigate child abuse claims. And I think, I couldn't imagine a more horrific situation than to be a victim of child abuse in a home and there's nobody there to investigate. I mean, that's, So here, at least, is, I think, a very good idea. I'm sure there are opponents to it. But I think we are better off having these things looked into in real time and quickly addressed.
I think it opens the larger question of, contracting and privatization with government.
Yeah.
And there's parts of privatization that I think makes perfect sense. I mean, here in the city of St. Louis, they can't pave the roads. They have the money.
Right.
They can afford the materials.
Can't pick up
the trash.
They
don't have the people to do it.
Yeah.
And why they're not contracting with third parties, I don't know. One thing that makes me concerned about that, I think it's great, especially with child abuse, but ultimately these are things that are going to bring forth potentially criminal complaints.
Right.
And you put the power of arresting authority in the hands of...
No, they wouldn't have arresting authority. They would have investigatory authority.
Yeah, but...
And I would imagine that there's an awful lot of frivolous child abuse claims put in. Neighbors don't like each other. Family members are bickering, divorced spouses, and so forth. But these things need to be investigated, so it's a step in the right direction.
We lost the white rat this past week, and it's our first turn to talk about it. We'll do it after the news right here on KMOX.
Time for the Friday edition of Hancock and Kelly.
You two belong together.
John Hancock, Michael Kelly on News Radio 1120, KMOX.
And ever since December, every question that anybody asks me is this: what's it feel like to be a Hall of Famer? Well, I didn't know. I kept saying, I won't know till July 25th. Well, now I can tell you what it feels like. Being elected to the National Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York, is like going to heaven before you die. Thank you very much.
Oh, that's sweet. I don't know that I remembered that speech.
Yeah, that was his Hall of Fame induction speech, 2010. That, of course, the late now, Whitey Herzog, historic figure in St. Louis Cardinal baseball history, came in and really rescued a struggling franchise at the time.
Yeah, it had an interesting story, but I got to tell you, just as a personal note, you know how when you're younger, you don't fully grasp the way the world works.
Yeah.
And so when I was younger, there were three people that I assumed would have the jobs they have forever. Ronald Reagan was the president of the United States when I was becoming conscious. And I was like, well, yeah, what do you mean when we started to get a new president and they were talking about someday there'd be a new? What do you mean there'd be somebody other than Ronald Reagan? The Pope, John Paul II, and the manager of the Cardinals. I had no idea. You know, because my whole conscious life, Whitey Herzog, what do you mean we're getting a new
that
manager?
All happened, all three of those things happened at about the same time, I think. I know exactly. Whitey came in 1980, Reagan was elected in 1980, not sure when John Paul was named Pope, but it was right around that same time.
Well, Gussie Bush, Mr. Bush, who bought the team, built the stadium, and, you know, the legacy of the brewery, of course, went out and brought Whitey Herzog here. He made him not only the manager, but eventually the general manager, and they had a unique friendship. How unique was being the manager and the general manager at that time?
Yeah,
in baseball?
It was not unheard of at that time, but it was rare. And now it's I can't envision that ever happening again in baseball. I suppose it could. A guy like a Joe Maddon might have enough swag that he could get hired to do both, but it would be very rare. And it was rare then. And, you know, Herzog, the Cardinals were an interesting ball club throughout the 70s. They made a fundamentally poor trade in 1971, sending Steve Carlton to the Phillies for a right-hander named Rick Wise, who was a fine pitcher, but he wasn't Steve Carlton. And, you know, the Cardinals would have had in 72, 73, 74, a pitching staff that could have included, I mean, this is unbelievable to think about, could have included Bob Gibson, Steve Carlton, Jerry Royce, who the Cardinals let go, who was a fine pitcher, and then Bob Forsch came up in that window, who was a fine, I mean, we could have had an elite staff and a decent offense on those teams of the 70s, anchored by Ted Simmons, Keith Hernandez. They had some good ball players in the 1970s, but they didn't win, and they were losing, and the fan base was dwindling, and they weren't drawing. And into that mix comes Whitey Herzog, and just a genius of a baseball mind. And he looked at the team, and he said, well, you got a team of guys that hit fly balls to the warning track. And, you know, that's a tough stadium. And in those days, Bush was even harder. They eventually moved the fences in. But in that whole 70s, early 80s era, you didn't hit home runs at Bush Stadium. It was a pitcher's park. And he wanted to build this team based on speed and defense. And that's what he did. And he got rid of some. He got rid of Ted Simmons, very popular player in St. Louis, still lives in St. Louis. He's got a statue now outside of Bush Stadium.
Right.
And got rid of him. People forget we had Raleigh Fingers.
Mm-hmm.
Never pitched for the Cardinals. But they signed, traded for Raleigh Fingers, and then they traded for Bruce Sutter. And they used then Raleigh Fingers as part of the trade to the to do a lot of the things that Whitey did. And he put this team together. And, man, it was so exciting. Such good. You don't see teams playing that style anymore. Although baseball's trying to get back there, making the bases a little bigger, getting rid of the shift. You know, trying to build the speed element back into the game. But those teams in the 1980s were, you know.
Was he your favorite Cardinal manager ever?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we had, you know, Red Shandings was a great manager. And he took the Cardinals to the pennant in to the World Series in 67, the pennant in 68. But then those teams of the 70s, and Red was let go. And I remember the the Vern Rapp era. He's the guy that made the mad Hungarian shave off his Fu Manchu. He's a horrible manager.
Wow.
Cardinals brought Ken Boyer in for a cup of coffee as the manager, the great third baseman. He was the manager immediately prior to the hiring of Whitey Herzog in June of 1980.
Well, Whitey Herzog will be missed. I know it's been well eulogized here at KMOX, but rest in peace.
Told a great story. I heard, so, you know, the call, the 85 World Series, Don Dinkinger. And in, I guess it would have been 2005, they were celebrating the 20th anniversary of that team, and they had a dinner, and Whitey, and Dinkinger was a good umpire. He just missed that call, and a really good guy. And so they invited Don Dinkinger to give the keynote speech at the dinner honoring the 1985 Cardinal team, and he came. He was retired at that point.
Right.
And so he gives his speech, and Whitey stands up, and he says, we got a little something for you, and he gives him, and it's a Rolex watch.
Wow.
And Dinkinger's, wow, that's very kind of you. And Whitey says, take a close look at it. It was Braille.
Hey, speaking of taking a close look at Major League Baseball, so I know there's been some questions about, wow, that doesn't seem like there's many people going down to the Cardinal games right now. Still a healthy crowd, and that's partly because of the baseball season. But I've noticed throughout baseball, I saw a game yesterday that was some pictures from Pittsburgh. Of course, we saw it from Oakland.
Right.
Attendance is way down for baseball. I wonder if they are concerned that they've got a long-term problem on their hand.
Yeah, and you know, Miami doesn't draw. Cincinnati really doesn't draw.
It will draw 3 million people. I'm not talking about St. Louis.
Right.
I'm talking about baseball in general.
As long as the team's competitive, you're going to draw here. You know, and it would take back-to-back seasons, like last season. If we replicate that this season, then you'll start to see some real hemorrhaging at that point. But there are a number of franchises that don't draw well. Most of the teams in the league make their money off of the television contracts.
Right.
You know? And that's all up in the air with what's happened at Bally's and all of that. So, and merchandising has become a bigger part of the game. That's why the Dodgers can pay Shohei Ohtani that kind of money, because of the merchandising revenue he generates for that club. And, of course, the Dodgers draw very well every season. But, you know, there's so many of these teams that the fan base knows they don't have a chance.
Right.
And so when you get to that place, it makes it kind of tough, you know. And the Blues are going through that right now. They second year in a row not making the playoffs, you know, just 4 years removed from winning the Stanley Cup. You know, and they have decided against going on a full out rebuild and getting rid of all of their stars, which a lot of teams have done. But you're looking at a 6-7-8 year process at that point, and you really take a hit in attendance, and it doesn't look like the Blues are going to do that. And the Cardinals are certainly not in a position where that's even an option for them. So,
yeah, I just asked because I saw some picture of Pittsburgh. I mean, it looked like the games. Remember when we had COVID games and they were putting the little cardboard cutouts on the back?
Yeah.
That's crazy times. Hey, he's John Hancock. I'm Michael Kelly. We're going to stick around till 10 o'clock. Then we're going to be joined by Amy and Chris for their show. We'll spend some time with them.
Yeah, there's some trial going on out there.
Yeah, get what trial?
Over in New York, there's a trial.
Huh, I haven't heard much
about it. Let's talk about that.
Let's talk about the trial after this right here on KMOX.
Now, back to Hancock and Kelly, sponsored by Insperity, HR that makes a difference, on News Radio 1120, KMOX.
Wait till you hear this one, John.
Yeah.
Donald Trump is complaining about something being rigged. What is that? Well, that'd be the court case that's against him right now in New York. But I feel like every time Donald Trump's making a complaint, it's some complaint he has that's going on against him. We are in day four of the Stormy Daniels hush money payoff trial that's taking place up in Washington or in New York City. You remember that Michael Cohen, the Trump consigliere, had paid off or admitted and pled guilty, went and served time in jail, saying that he was took money for legal fees and then used them to pay off Stormy Daniels. The question here is whether or not Stormy Daniels' money that would have been the government's directly related to the campaign, and that they were trying to hide the issue that they had there so that the former president circumvented campaign finance laws by doing it. On its surface, clearly it's gotten this far in the process. A guy's already gone to jail. Couple of questions for you. Number one, how do you think this shakes out? Number two, isn't it kind of frustrating we're not getting to see what's actually happening in the courtroom?
Yeah, I mean, I'll take the latter one first because we probably agree on that. Yeah, I think generally speaking, trials, particularly high-profile trials, and any trial involving a former president of the United States is by definition a high-profile trial, I think the American people ought to be able to see exactly what's going on, see what the prosecution has for evidence, see how the defense handles it, and, you know, basically make a judgment for themselves. Otherwise, you're going off of reporting, and we all know how siloed reporting is these days.
True that.
You're going to get, if you watch Fox News, you may not even know there's a trial going on.
Right.
And if you watch, you know, the others, you don't think anything else is happening in
right.
the world. So, I think you agree they ought to be.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I can see, I don't like the idea that these potential jurors are, you know, are finding themselves personally. And Rick, imagine you get jury duty and you got to show up to, and then all of a sudden you're in the middle of this mess and they're looking into your social media from 20 years ago. They're looking into your husband or your wife's social media. That's what's happening to these jurors right now. And, I mean, it's miserable enough already to be called for jury duty, and now you're going to be a part of a world story? Ugh.
Yeah, and, you know, it's impossible to find a jury pool anywhere that hasn't formed opinions about Donald Trump, I would think.
I've got an opinion.
So, you know, and that makes it tough. And I think this judge has got to have an eye towards the appeal, so even if Trump is convicted, this case is going to get appealed. And so the processes that this judge puts in place and the jury selection is a big part of it. He needs to ensure that he's not giving grounds to have the case overturned on appeal. Now, having said that, I don't think Donald Trump's going to be convicted in this case.
Why is that?
I think it's a very weak, tenuous case. It's basically two issues. There's campaign finance issues that, you know, the paying off the porn star should have been disclosed on his Federal Election Commission paperwork. And Cohen, you're correct, pled guilty to that charge as part of his overall. He was convicted for lying as well, perjuring himself. And the campaign finance charge was kind of thrown in there. He had some taxi license issues in New York as well that all kind of got bundled up and he pled guilty to it. But, you know, the only campaign finance case that I've ever seen go into trial in recent times, and because these things, they almost never result in anything. But you'll remember the John Edwards case.
Oh, yeah.
Who paid off his mistress. I mean, it was almost an identical case to this in the campaign finance aspect of it. And he went to trial and he was acquitted.
Uh-huh.
So there's that precedent out there. And I think a good lawyer can articulate to a jury that this is bogus to go after him for campaign violations. There's a plethora of reasons that a person would want to pay off a porn star, I suppose. Historically, that's not made for good politics, Michael. But
now it makes you the front runner for the GOP and sell a Bible.
The other aspect of the case is a tax fraud issue, because when you book payments to a porn star as legal expenses out of your business. Yes, those legal fees get written off of your taxes. So there's a tax violation, which could easily have been dealt with through a fine process, levying a fine against him for those taxes that he'd have paid it. And so I don't think this case is very meritorious. And I think the Georgia case is essentially crumbled. We'll see what happens with the D.C. case. One of these cases that is real, in my opinion, is the documents case.
A judge right. who's holding the whole process
up. Yeah, although she did deny a couple of motions by the tertiary defendants, Walt Nauta and the other guy, who wanted their cases dismissed, and she refused to do that. I think that was yesterday or the day before. But that case has real merit to it, and I hope that one gets adjudicated, because I want to know if it's knowable why Donald Trump chose to keep some of the most top level secrets, nuclear secrets, in his possession. I really don't understand that.
You and I do this on a daily basis. So we play politics, and I consider politics sometimes like surfing. If you were on a, you know, you're out there with your board and you're riding a wave, things mm-hmm. change and you have to move. How many times in a week, because I can answer this, it's almost, well, I don't want to spoil it. How many times during a week do you sometimes just have to take a moment and go, I cannot believe this is what is happening because it's so contrary to what we've experienced in politics yeah. before, whether it be a president or 90, you know, federal indictments, whether it be, you know, a president of the United States, you know, having some of these issues that he's had, Josh Hawley walking a picket line. I mean, there's so
got
many
endorsed
times.
By the Teamsters.
Yes, there are. No, I think he got some money. Whether or not he got endorsed, okay. I think is question, okay. and right. it's up in the air. But there are so many times now in politics where I'm just like, I can't believe this is the world I'm in, but I got to accept it. Let's go ride that wave.
Yeah. I mean, I would never have predicted the last decade was about to hit us.
Yeah.
You know, and I missed the whole Donald Trump phenomenon. I just didn't think he would be able to get through the primary, let alone win the White House, but he did.
Right.
And I didn't appreciate until I had to confront it face to face just how that populist message resonates with our voters. I mean, it's the part, he's the party, you know, 10 years from now, long after Donald Trump's gone, the Republican Party most likely is going to be a populist nationalistic party. And the Trump folks who rail against the establishment are going to be the establishment.
They already are.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of the funny things that I think is the funniest about listening to the rhetoric that comes out of Jefferson City.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to fight this liberal agenda that's coming. What liberal agenda? You're in Missouri, man. We're as backwards as they get. You guys control every aspect of life. And I listen to these governor candidates talk to me about, I'm down there defeating liberal nonsense. There are no liberals. There are none.
Well, there's a few down there. Yeah, they got a few.
Yeah, they're like me. They're the ones who are cleaning the building. They're not the ones who are standing on the floor with the other
folks. Well, they don't have the numbers to make policy, I think would be an accurate reflection. But there are definitely genuine liberals out there.
Oh, hey, they're fighting.
We got the news around the corner. When we come back, got introduced to a fellow a couple weeks ago who made his way here in St. Louis, eventually recording his first album at Abbey Road Studio. Got to meet the Beatles.
What?
He recorded an album at the age of 17 at Abbey Road. He's since gone on to a musical career. He does a lot of composing and writing, living in Florida these days. Tom Hartman is his name, St. Louisan, and he joins us after the news right here on KMOX.
Hi, this is Nolan Arenado, and it's game day.
It's the Cards and Brewers tonight. Ameren Total Access, 620. First pitch, 7:15.
Let's play ball.
On your voice of the Cardinals, KMOX.
It's a new world of you, and I'm just a stranger here.
That sound you hear is the Aerovons, a band born with its roots right here in St. Louis so many years ago. That voice you hear was Tom Hartman, and the song you hear is World of You. It's by the Aerovons, and joining us now on the Quiver River Electric Celebrity Guest Line is St. Louis's own Tom Hartman. Welcome back home, big boy.
Hey, it's been a while. How you doing up there?
We're doing great. You're down in Florida these days. Take me back to your age 17 self, and tell me what unfolded for you right here in St. Louis.
Well, it was actually age 16 when that whole thing started. And, you know, we just started as any other band would have at the time. But the difference was we actually had a great manager in the form of my mom, to my great embarrassment, because she offered it. And while I was, you know, a little gun shy about that, it turned out that she was really good at getting us moving forward at the time in all the top clubs there in St. Louis at the time, and even playing the seventh inning stretch at Busch which was, I guess, a temporary experiment that the Cardinals or Bush did back then. They started having bands at the stretch time. So we got in there. We pretty much had played everywhere we could and done everything we could as far as being a local band there. And the next step was to make a demo.
So you're pretty much a child prodigy. I mean, you were developing this musical skill at a very young age. At the age of 16, 17, you're attending high school. And it wouldn't be St. Louis if I didn't ask you what high school you attended.
Oh, well, it was Bayless. And that's where the group started. That's where I found Bob Frank and started adding a bunch of different players who kept changing, but Bob was kind of the anchor, the rhythm guitarist, and myself, and so it was Bayless, yeah.
Bayless High School. So Mom's out there. She's negotiating, getting you playing all the clubs all over town, and it's come time to put together a demo tape. How'd that work out for you?
Well, we made a tape, a recording down at a place back then called Premier Recording Studios. And, you know, it was a studio, not in the sense of today's studios that are used to recording rock riffs. There were just a couple older gentlemen there who were mainly doing voiceover recordings for local commercials and that kind of thing. And we showed up there as a rock band and did a demo, and they called us about a week later and said, listen, you were in here recording last week, and we just wanted you to know that a representative from Capitol Records at the time had a distribution center in St. Louis. And he said, they came in here and we played them what we recorded of you guys. And they were very interested, so they will be calling you. So it was kind of like something out of an old bad 50s rock movie, kind of an unbelievable plot. A Capitol guy called and said that he thought California Capitol would be interested in hearing this. And I was, just so enamored of recording in England where the Beatles did that. You know, we said, we really have a dream of recording over at EMI, which at the time owned Capitol. And the guy was a little taken aback, and he said, well, if that's true, here's a name for you guys to go contact in London at EMI. He gave us Roy Featherstone, who later ended up signing Queen. And that's how it all happened. We got in touch with him, flew over there, played the demo for him, and he kind of shook his head and said, yeah, we'll do a single on this. And he said, we're very impressed that a St. Louis group would want to come all the way over here to record. And he said, most of our groups want to leave here and come to America to record. Well,
you know, it's clearly, in listening to the music of the Aerovans, you guys were heavily influenced by the Beatles.
Oh, yeah.
And,
yeah.
I mean, that the piece, that little snippet we played to intro you,
yeah.
I mean, it had a very Beatlesque vibe to it and feel to it. So you end up over there at Abbey Road Studio. Did you ever meet the Beatles?
Yes, on numerous occasions. And it was a heart-stopping event for a young guy who had just, I had been playing guitar as a young kid for a couple of years before the Beatles came out. So I was already into Beach Boys and Everly Brothers and all that stuff. And when I Want to Hold Your Hand came out and KXOK back then played it for the first time, that pretty much decided the kind of curve of where my life was going to head. I was so, it was such an intense record for me from the standpoint of guitars and all the things that I like in music that I became so fanatical about them that to meet them a few years later at the studio was really hard to describe the feeling.
What kind of guys were they?
They were, if you went into a recording studio locally and some local band was recording there walking down the hall, that's how they were. They were so down to earth. It was like, you had to pinch yourself to realize that you had just walked by. There were times that we walked by all four of them. They'd all four be walking down the hall, toward maybe Studio One where they were doing a session, and we'd be on our way to Studio Two, and you'd have to pass each other in the hall. And it wasn't unusual to pass one of them, but there were days when all four of them would be walking towards you.
Well, that had to be early on if they were all four together all the time.
Yeah, yeah. They weren't all the time, but way more than you hear when you hear stories about, I don't know, they were fighting and they were, you know, they may have been fighting, but when we were around them, they were cutting up and laughing in the studio and this, you know, and they just had a lot of patience because we were young kids. And when we spoke with them, we kind of drove them crazy, particularly Paul and George. I had tons of guitar questions, and they would just lean up against the wall at the studio and say, yeah, where you from? What studio? Where'd you come from? What studio are you in today? And that stuff. It was just like talking to ordinary people. You would never know they were who they were.
That's pretty cool. So here you are. You're 17 years old. You've got a single at Abbey Road.
Yeah.
It's a good piece of music. And then the band, it didn't work, the Aravons, and you had kind of went through different ways. Tell me about, because you've spent a lifetime now in the music business. You've made your living in the music business. What evolved for Tom Hartman out of those early days as a teenager?
Well, I ended up, we ended up breaking up when we got back to the U.S. There were a number of reasons, and they're well documented, but I was given the chance by EMI to go back there. And not the kind of personality that would say, I'll do it, at 17. I had just spent 3 months there eating what was possibly the worst food I had ever experienced. I got back to St. Louis, and we ended up going out to L.A. and signing a contract with Mike Post, who became like the television composer of all time, I think, and he was doing records and
wrote the Rockford Files.
Yes, he did. And he was a super good guy. And after we did a single with him, it didn't go anywhere. And he said, Tommy, all the people I have signed for Bell Records, Bell is doing nothing with them. They're not promoting it. So he said, you can come on out here and give it another try with another label and use my name as producer.
Wow.
And I said, well, I got accepted at SIU. I don't know what to do. And he said, Tommy, go to school. You've got the rest of your life to do music. So that's what I did. I went to SIU. And from there, I kind of backed into doing music for, documentaries and commercials and things like that. We ended up moving to Florida, and my career kind of in that field just took off in the 80s. I started doing a lot of jingle work for big companies, the Army, the Air Force, and Blockbuster Video and stuff like that. And, it made a good living, and it was easy for me because you pretty much had to write a 30-second hit record. You had to write a pop, catchy thing, and so I found that pretty easy. So that's what I started doing after I got out of the group thing, and I still do that for hire today, although less of that and more independent production. People come to me.
If people want to learn more, I could talk to you all day, Tom.
Oh,
if people want to learn more or hear your music, is there a website that you prefer them to check out?
Really, you can find a lot of stuff up on YouTube, and the what's odd is I'm still doing my own original stuff and released an album a couple years ago called A Little More, which is up on Spotify and Apple Music and all the usual subjects, and it got good enough reviews that seriously considering a third. It's kind of hard to stop this stuff once you start,
Well, that is Tom Hartman, a proud prodigy of Bayless High School, who found his way to London, England at Abbey Road Studio and has had a very impressive career in the music industry. great to chat with you today, Tom. Really enjoyed it. We'll have to do this again.
Thank you so much for having me on.
All right.
That's John Hancock. I'm Michael Kelly. When we come back, John Hancock is going across the pond. We'll find out exactly what for after this on KMOX.
KMOX, your connection to St. Louis and the region. Because staying informed starts here.
Well, my friend John Hancock's going to be leaving me for a couple of weeks. He's headed over to England, jolly old England, yeah, to go to the Snooker World Championships that's place in where?
Sheffield.
And so when do you come back?
We're going to be in London for several days, and then we take the train to Sheffield and the Crucible Theater, the historic Crucible Theater. 50 years it has hosted the World Snooker World Championship.
And you've got tickets to be there for the semifinals.
Yes.
Good for you.
And not tickets, front row.
Hey now, I must be in the front row.
I will be one seat away from whichever player is in the left-hand corner. Seated, and if he's there, if he makes the semifinals, always in the left-hand corner is none other than Ronnie O'Sullivan, the greatest snooker player to have ever lived, going for his eighth world title in Sheffield, and it would be his sixth tournament win this season. He's already won the Masters and the UK Championship. This would give him a true triple crown in the same year for the great Ronnie O'Sullivan, and if I happen to be blessed to be able to sit there while he's playing, it will be
I hope it happens
sublime.
For
It'll be
you.
Sublime.
I hope this happens for you.
It's a word they use over there all the time. Sublime. Yeah.
So tell us, is this your first trip to Europe?
First
trip out of the country?
Been to Mexico. But that's it. That's about
it. That's an easy border to cross. You don't have to worry about traveling.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a little nervous about all the customs and all this, you know, can't bring your sandwiches over there or whatever it is.
No, you just behave, pay attention, and do what Georgian says.
Yeah.
And, you know, if people start asking questions, just pretend like you don't speak English. Huh?
Oh, no. Huh? No. You think they'll know I'm from America?
Yeah, I think your size may give it away.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, we're larger humans than what I encounter in England. Yeah, that's been my experience, and they all have them flat bellies over there.
Oh, they do.
Even as older people.
You hate to see that.
Hey, so what we got coming up is Chris and Amy. We've got to step aside. People can see us Sunday morning, Fox 2, at 8:30 a.m., where you can see Hancock and Kelly, the television show. It's always a pleasure to get to spend our Friday mornings with you. Stick around, Amy and Chris, Hancock and Kelly, next on KMOX.